Welcome to our Bible study on the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 25, verses 31 through 46. As always, I am assuming you have read the Bible passage, that you have your Bible open before you, and that you understand our translations may not agree. I also invite you to our in-person Bible study held on Wednesdays from 5:15 until 6 p.m. in classrooms 1 and 2. With this teaching, Jesus concludes his public instruction, a climatic point that to which Matthew has carefully built. And if the principle of instress is at work here, then Matthew wants this to be the lingering lesson in our ears. This last teaching follows a long series of parables and warnings that began back in chapter 24 about living responsibly so as to be ready for the coming of the Son of Man. For example, in chapter 24, verses 45 through 51, we heard about the absentee landlord who put his servant in charge. In chapter 25, verses 1 through 13, we heard about a bridegroom who arrives so late the guests fall asleep. And in chapter 25, verse 14 through 30, we heard about a master who distributes talents among his servants and leaves. All of these center around a theme of what happens when the master slash bridegroom is delayed. Our passage is unique to Matthew. There is no parallel in Mark or Luke, and although it is often called a parable, it is really an apocalyptic drama, a vision of the last judgment. Parables begin with something familiar. For example, a sower goes out to sow seeds, and then moves into a new dimension of meaning. But in our passage, we have a visible description of the parousia, the coming of the Son of Man, with his angels and the gathering of all nations before his throne, that points to the ultimate importance of our activity in the here and now. The purpose of the vision is not speculation about the end, as much as it is a vehicle for ethical instruction. Notice, the vision is not about the Son of Man coming to the earth, but to the throne in heavenly glory, where the Son of Man is being installed as king and judge, as we see in verses 34 and 40. The coming has been dealt with earlier. In chapter 24, verse 47, we are told it will be sudden as the lightning. In 24, 30 through 30, 31, it will be on clouds of glory and with great power. And at chapter 24, verses 36 through 42, we are reminded that the day and the hour are unknown. At chapter 24, verse 43, we are told it will be like a burglar entering at night. And in chapter 24, verses 45 through 51, we are told it will be a time of reckoning and woe to the unprepared. These passages, as well as the parables alluded to earlier of the bridegroom delay and the parable of the talents deal with the delay of the coming. But now comes the full vision, glorious in appearance, cosmic in scope, and yet personal in that every life must appear before the judgment seat. Some of the terms used to describe the vision are drawn from a treasury of Jewish thought. For example, in verse 33, right and left were common terms in both Jewish and Gentile culture for the favored and unfavored position. In verse 34, inherit the kingdom comes from Israel's tradition about the promised land. Also in verse 34, from the foundation of the world draws upon the view that all that was essential for God's eternal purpose was created before the world was made. In other words, all that pertains to God's will is not contingent upon anything besides God. This is the only scene in the Gospels with any details picturing the last judgment, and the surprise is that the criterion of judgment is not confession of faith in Jesus as the Christ, the Messiah, or the Son of God. In this vision, nothing is said of grace, justification, or the forgiveness of sins. In this passage, what counts is whether or not we have acted with loving care for needy people. Such deeds are not a matter of extra credit, but make up the decisive nature of the judgment. Three elements in the vision draw special attention. First, as was just pointed out, the basis for the final judgment in verses 35 through 36 is our response to human need. These needs are not unusual. They are part of the ordinary ins and outs of our daily life. Second, as we see in verses 37 through 39 and verse 44, both those at the right and the left are surprised that they have served or failed to serve Christ. This touch of being surprised is a beautiful portrait of those whose service to others is so much a part of their behavior that they are amazed that service to those in need is also service to Christ. And the element of surprise also describes those who bypassed the scenes of human anguish. You may recall back in chapter 7, verses 21 through 23, those that were rejected, even though that they made valid claims to have prophesied, cast out demons, and performed miracles. The point being that nothing could be more religious and more faithful than attending to those who need care. Third, as was pointed out in chapter 10, verses 40 through 42, service to another is service to Christ. Here, the point is dramatized and elevated to ultimate importance. Of course, one of the difficulties of this teaching is trying to avoid turning the truth of the importance of service to others into a strategy for assuring our own salvation. If we are only thinking of helping ourselves, how are we serving others or Christ? So, as we come to the end of this passage, a question may arise. Are we saved by good works or by grace? One way to look at this is that the good works in our passage don't earn us heaven because those who did the good works didn't realize they had done anything good. We could possibly interpret this to mean that caring for others was such a part of their nature that the caring acts came naturally and apparently unconsciously, like a good tree naturally producing good fruit. The tree doesn't have to think about producing fruit. It just happens. The same for the caring of people. They don't think about producing good fruits. It just happens. It's part of their nature. Some of us may have experienced a similar surprise when someone comes up to us and says, "When you said or what you said or did really helped me a lot," and we are trying to remember what we said or did that was so great. Often, we don't know what good we are doing, only to discover later that we were helpful. Carrying this idea a little bit further, we hear how the righteous are surprised because they don't know their deeds. To paraphrase Matthew chapter 6, verse 3, their left hand did not seem to know what their right hand was doing. They haven't kept score. They were unaware of their own righteousness. They didn't even know they possessed it. Maybe the idea is that we are called to do good works, but we are also called not to keep score. To use a bookkeeping term, when we keep score of our deeds, we want to credit our love of neighbor to a heavenly bank account. If we look again at verse 34, we see the phrase, "inherit the kingdom," and inheritance is determined by the giver, not the receiver. It is what God has done in Jesus that allows us to receive our inheritance, receive God's grace, and receive God's kingdom. This concludes our study. Thank you for listening. Take care, and God bless.